Hello and welcome to RCSI My Health. This podcast explores a wide range of areas in health and well-being and brings together some of the leading healthcare experts in these fields. Our goal is to empower you with the right knowledge so that you can make informed decisions about your health and well-being. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hello and welcome to the RCSI My Health series supported by Fleming Medical. I'm Dr. Sarah Barry from the School of Population Health, and today we're going to discuss cardiovascular disease in women, focusing on risk factors, prevention and supports. The series explores a wide range of areas in health and well-being and brings together some of the leading healthcare experts in these fields. We have the goal of empowering people with the knowledge to make informed decisions about their own health and well-being. Today, I'm joined by Professor Robert Byrne, Director of Cardiology at the Mater Private Hospital here in Dublin and Chair of Cardiovascular Research at RCSI. Dr. Robert Kelly. Robert is Senior Lecturer at RCSI in Clinical and Lifestyle Medicine and consultant in cardiology and medical director, lifestyle, health and well-being at the Beacon Hospital in Dublin. Robert is also a board member at the European Lifestyle Medicine Organisation, and he is co-founder of the Irish Society of Lifestyle Medicine. Dr. Una O'Neill is a general practitioner at Mercer's Medical Practice, and she is also a GP trainer in the RCSI GP training programme. Welcome to the RCSI My Health series. We're going to start off proceedings by going directly to you, Robert Byrne, and just asking you, how do cardiovascular problems present in men and women?
Well, thanks very much for the question. I think cardiovascular problems, it's kind of a broad term, and actually it encompasses a spectrum of conditions. The most common ones would be coronary artery disease or a disease due to narrowings of the heart arteries, or stroke, which is caused by a blockage to blood vessels in the brain or a bleed on the brain. And actually, these conditions tend to present with fairly classical symptoms that we know a lot about. So in terms of coronary artery disease, it might present in a stable manner or in a sudden manner. Usually we refer to heart attack. And that can often be a discomfort in the chest, a feeling of pressure in the chest, sometimes associated with breathlessness or a sweaty feeling. Whereas stroke, we probably all know from some of the public awareness campaigns, tends to present with weakness in the face, weakness in the arm or leg. So they'd be the classical symptoms in men or in women.
And are there particular differences in symptoms experienced maybe across different age cohorts, for example?
Yeah, certainly there's some variability in the symptoms that patients develop. We notice it in terms of gender differences, particularly in relation to how heart disease presents or heart attack. While most patients will present with similar complaints, whether they're a man or a woman, there is some research to suggest that in women, the symptoms can be a little bit more disguised. They might be more in the line, instead of typical chest discomfort or pressure, perhaps a sensation of discomfort in the jaw, in the teeth region, in the shoulders, in the back of the neck, or more commonly breathlessness rather than chest discomfort. So those are important differences that I think patients and doctors need to be aware of.
Okay, thank you. Robert Kelly, can I focus a question now more particularly in your direction around women's cardiovascular health? Are there particular symptoms or health issues that really relate specifically to younger women or indeed women at middle age or at a menopausal stage or older stage of life?
So thank you for the question. I just add to Robert's comment that I suppose in women sometimes the symptoms come on when women are at rest, whereas typically men, the story is when you're exerting yourself, you get a lot of those symptoms. I think another symptom that occurs probably in the older women is you come across this kind of generalized fatigue or just unusually tired that's not explained that might represent the onset or the existence of heart disease. And I suppose the other comment to make as well is a lot of younger women, you tend to see often similar chest pain symptoms that are sometimes explained by other circumstances. So one of the heart conditions that causes heart attacks is where younger women might tear an artery. It's called a spontaneous coronary dissection. And sometimes you see that in younger women who get very significant chest pain shortly after they've delivered a baby during pregnancy. So that is something to consider as well.
You know, this condition of kind of, you know, sudden death syndrome, is that a factor for younger women at all? We usually hear about young men with this condition mostly.
It is a factor for men and women. We do seem to see a much more disproportionate amount of men actually with sudden cardiac death than we do with women, but it still happens in both groups. It is associated with exercise, but it's also associated with people who don't exercise. I suppose the importance in that condition is that if you have any of these symptoms in particular, the chest pains, dizziness, or particularly dizziness when you're playing a sport or doing an activity or you've passed out in that way, but in the context where you might have a family history that somebody else has dropped dead suddenly, and again, drop dead in a younger person is usually under 40, and then add to that if there's any family history of anything significant for those types of conditions. Well, those types of conditions for any woman out there at that particular age group is essential to go and see a specialist and get checked out. It's not something to be ignored.
Okay, thank you. Una, if I could turn to you, what would you normally see in the GP clinic in terms of, you know, the presentation that people come to you with or the symptoms that they display?
Sure. So as Robert was saying, women and men actually present quite similarly with that crushing chest, elephant on the chest type pain. But as the guys mentioned, you know, often women also have other symptoms like the fatigue and breathlessness, but also things like dizziness, palpitations, nausea. And sometimes, you know, they will feel pain in their chest, but also, you know, perhaps the pain in the back is as bad. So sometimes that chest pain can be downplayed. And as a result, we can sometimes, you know, pay less attention to it because we don't expect heart disease in women the same way, or at least we didn't expect heart disease in the same woman as men, especially younger women, you know. But so that's something that we really need to keep an eye on, because I think in the past sometimes, you know, those symptoms have been attributed to, say, palpitations of menopause or linked in with anxiety or reflux disease when actually they were cardiac in nature. And also in the practice, we would see people with, you know, cardiovascular risks like blood pressure, diabetes, obesity. And these seem to affect women disproportionately to men. So, you know, a woman with diabetes is more likely to have heart disease than a man with diabetes at the same age. So, you know, we really need to be aware of both the risk factors as well as the acute presentations.
Yeah. Are there any, just to go, you know, slightly off script slightly, are there any kind of social factors that, you know, can mask or cause people to kind of not actually think that there's a heart event happening for them?
I think, you know, on some level, we'd think that women don't have heart disease because we know that we have this protective effect of estrogen. And I think both clinicians and patients kind of can be a little bit complacent and think, well, that's not the heart, when in fact it often is. You know, cardiovascular disease is the, you know, a main killer for women, and we need to be aware of it.
So we're going to just shift our discussion now a little bit more towards thinking about risk factors, and particularly in the case of women who are at the menopausal stage of life. Robert, if I can come back to you, Robert Kelly, you know, are there risk factors that relate specifically to younger women? Let's just start with that.
I suppose the major risk factor in the younger population, beyond the family history discussion we had, is smoking. Yeah. It's probably the major risk factor. I think, as we've just been mentioning, obesity is catching up with that very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And I think that apart from that, obesity of itself will lead to blood pressure, diabetes, and associated cholesterol and metabolic issues. So unfortunately, the possibility of seeing these things that were traditionally associated with the middle-aged women is now much more likely to emerge at the younger age women.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then there is those considerations around drug misuse, cocaine in particular as a cause of chest pain, and alcohol consumption as well, and other drug use in their contribution to risk factors, particularly like blood pressure, which when uncontrolled may trigger symptoms. So it's very much similar. I suppose you mentioned social things. I suppose the social habits of the younger population unfortunately do expose you to risks of heart disease and of strokes at a much younger age.
You mentioned cocaine, and it's interesting given what's happening in the country currently and the prevalence, apparently, of cocaine use. Have you seen, you know, a very marked increase in this kind of a risk factor presenting?
I would be aware as a parent, and I would be aware, just like you, from the public media, of a significant cocaine issue. My memory of cocaine is that when I was training in America, my youngest heart attack patient I ever treated was 28 years of age, who came in, had an angiogram with me, and I was alarmed to find that his coronary arteries were effectively missing. He was still very much alive, but they were like little threads, no treatment possible. And the risk factor was he was taking cocaine on a fairly daily basis, was quite ignorant to the risk of what this caused. And I was quite alarmed that you could literally have this issue. But when I went on to look up cocaine and its dangers, discovered that one of the greatest risks of cocaine is it can cause you to drop dead. It can trigger the heart to actually stop. So as much as destroying your coronary arteries, that 28-year-old man will not receive any treatment. Even though he's 28, because he is a drug addict by definition, he won't be suitable for any form of heart transplantation. So his life, it may be weeks, days or months. In the situation clearly of sudden death, there is a reality there that the cocaine can cause that. And so it's a very clear indicator against taking any drugs of that nature for the risks that it can cause you to drop dead.
Interesting. And Una, just to kind of shift a little bit back into thinking about the menopause and that stage of life, how does menopause specifically affect women's risk of heart disease and stroke?
Sure. It's interesting, Sarah, because whenever somebody comes into me in the practice and they're perimenopausal or menopausal, you know, often they'll ask, should I get a mammogram, or, you know, what about a DEXA scan to measure the thickness of my bones? But actually, cardiovascular disease, you know, should be the ultimate priority in a woman, you know, who's at that point in her life, because a woman is six times more likely to die of cardiovascular disease than breast cancer. So it's a really significant issue. And estrogen, when we have it, when our ovaries are still making plenty of estrogen, it relaxes and opens the vessels that Robert's just been talking about, and it helps maintain healthy cholesterol levels. And then when our ovaries start to go to sleep at the time of perimenopause or switch off at menopause, then we lose that benefit, and then we start to get, you know, much less flexible vessels because of that lack of estrogen. Our blood pressure starts to go up, you know, our cholesterol is less managed. So menopause has a really significant effect on cardiovascular health, you know. There's also, if I can just mention, a couple of additional risk factors that women need to be aware of that I think even as clinicians we're only really starting to pay more attention to, and that is that if a woman has certain you know, conditions or risks that affect her before menopause, so for example, if she has a pregnancy that is affected by high blood pressure or preeclampsia or gestational diabetes, or even a preterm labour, this makes it much more likely for her to have cardiovascular disease after the menopause. So really, you know, women need to be aware of that. We need to be screening, you know, in general practice and in the hospitals more for this kind of condition to try and stratify risk for our patients.
Get a sense of that profile.
Yeah.
I'm sure our audience would be very interested to hear, you know, what's your experience with HRT and this, you know, question around hormone replacement therapy, and is it safe to take with regard to cardiovascular health and risk factors, given what you've just said about, I mean, I'm really surprised to hear the six times more risky than some of the other kind of elements that you would think about as a woman.
Sure. So, you know, HRT is basically replacing that estrogen that you're missing at the time when your ovaries stop making it. And it's, you know, it's kept company by progesterone, which we also prescribe in everybody except women who maybe who've had a hysterectomy. And those two hormones stop us from having the symptoms of menopause, which is why you take HRT in the first place. There was a concern about 20 years ago that perhaps taking estrogen actually made cardiovascular disease worse. But since, when those studies were kind of dissected a little bit, it was discovered that it was very old estrogen that was, it was an old form of estrogen. It was a very high dose, and the women in the studies were actually in their 70s, a lot of them. So since then, we've realised that, you know, if you are going to use HRT, it's actually cardioprotective if used very close to the time of menopause, very close to the time of the woman's last period. And, you know, in a woman who is, you know, perhaps 50 as opposed to 65. And in that scenario, it actually is cardioprotective. The progesterones that we use now, those bioavailable micronized progesterones that people talk about, they actually help reduce the bad cholesterol in the blood. So there's a lot of positives to HRT, but we do need to work out a woman's cardiovascular risks before, you know, starting everybody on it, because, you know, it really needs to be tailored to the patient, and the type of HRT that we use also needs to be tailored.
So it's really, really in the context of a discussion with your GP, that's for
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. So, you know, I'd have patients who are maybe on HRT for a couple of years, and as they're getting into their 60s, we would always try and change them to transdermal estrogen because that's much safer. And then if we're kind of a little bit worried that perhaps their cardiovascular disease risk is starting to increase, we might involve the cardiologist to help us work out, maybe they might do other tests like, you know, angiograms, to help us work out risk and safety for HRT.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. I'm going to shift the discussion a little bit now towards our kind of third part, which is around prevention and support. Robert, I'm going to turn to you, Robert Kelly, again. And could you tell us a little bit about how lifestyle medicine, which is your area of expertise, aligns with cardiology and chronic disease?
So, first of all, I'm going to define what lifestyle medicine is. So lifestyle medicine is an evidence area specialty of medicine, just like cardiology, which is concerned with the prevention, the treatment, and potentially the reversal of chronic diseases. So chronic diseases are responsible for 80% of the reasons why people get sick in life, why they end up in hospital. And on the basis of lifestyle medicine, you can either prevent these from happening. In many cases, you can treat them, or you can potentially reverse some of them. So chronic diseases would include blood pressure, as the example is mentioned, obesity, chronic obstructive airways disease is a chronic disease. A lot of the cancers are chronic diseases. So there's a number of them there in the context of disease. Now, lifestyle medicine is based on six pillars. So the first pillar relates to your diet and the choice of food that you consume. The second pillar relates to exercise, physical activity, and the types of exercise that you do. The third pillar relates to your sleeping. The fourth pillar relates to your stress management. The fifth pillar relates to the social connection, family relationships you have. And the last pillar relates to addictions, the smoking, the alcohol, and the drugs that we've already spoken about. Yeah. So it's really a combination of a lot of different facets of medicine, not just clinicians, but also exercise therapy, nutritionists, and also a behavioural aspect to it, combined together in terms of delivering treatment and care to patients.
And, I mean, when you think of people who are, I suppose there's a lot of kind of prevention kind of, you know, approach there in what you outline. But particularly for cardiology, you know, patients you already have and treating, especially women, you know, what would be, if you like, out of that six, you know, approaches, where are the kind of main areas where people who already have had maybe some kind of an event need to take action?
The truth is you really need to take action in all six areas. I think some of them embed with each other, but the most common reason that people develop chronic diseases worldwide relate to diet. So either people are overeating, so that's the obesity relationship. It's not as simple as that, but it is diet-related. And activity is a huge one as well, because there's a very significant amount of people, including women at a younger age, who don't take much physical activity at all. So they're the two primary ones. We did mention drug use already. Smoking falls into the same category, that people shouldn't be smoking for the risk it contributes to disease. And then stress is something that I see an awful lot of. I'm sure my colleague Robert sees the same in clinical practice in terms of the type of patients that are coming through, struggling with a lot of stress and the nature of work. And ironically, women get much more stressed than men do, because women, in addition to working, tend to bring in the looking after the family and the children, and an awful lot of them work again on top of that, relates to their day job in the evening. So stress is a big, big factor, falling into a lot of mental health and emotional health issues. And then sleep, unfortunately, also comes often as a consequence of a lot of those other risk factors. So be it stress, be it eating late at night, be it exercising late at night, be it through any of those lifestyle factors contributing. And then the one other factor, which is the social connection factor, which is really, really important and probably more important to consider in that older age group. And that is, you know, where your father might die and your mother might be on her own, and your mother's risk of mortality is much, much higher being on her own. And the thing that's really protective during your life, believe it or not, is the time you spend with your own family, as opposed to the time you spend with your friends or with community groups. So there's getting your family involved and spending time as a family and doing things as a family is really, really positive for your health. I think one of the most practical reasons of those things I explain is having dinner with your kids, spending time going out with a greater family, going on holidays, doing the physical activity as a family is exceptionally beneficial to your health and to your heart health.
Yeah, I think I'm not mistaken in understanding that the literature would say that for those of us who are in partnerships, we tend to live longer. Is that correct?
Those of us, believe it or not, who are married or in partnerships do actually live longer. Yeah. But I do think, you know, you could still be single and have a very close family.
It's about the social connection is really the point.
The connection is really what the point is. And a lot of that's come since COVID, because a lot of people who are on their own or very isolated tend to have a much higher mortality independent of having COVID. So it just really raises that awareness. It's also around that time very much an issue that's been identified in cardiology, that there's an awful lot more mortality amongst heart patients who tend to be isolated and on their own.
Una, if I can come back to you, you know, in terms of being proactive, I mean, Robert has highlighted these six areas of action. For menopausal women, how can they really sort of support themselves, help themselves, sort of self-manage in terms of, you know, preventing?
Well, you know, as Robert's already said, you know, giving up smoking is huge, and, you know, it's never too late. There's lots of quitting smoking, you know, aids out there. And as I said, you know, smoking affects women disproportionately to, you know, to men. So it's really important. Taking exercise, you know, 30 minutes every day or 150 minutes a week, they say, and these are all numbers, but at the end of the day, staying active, gardening, walking, you know, get off the bus to stop early, all these things will count. Keeping the weight under control, making sure you don't binge on your alcohol intake, you know, keep it to a minimum. Trying to introduce, you know, the maybe meat-free days in your diet, trying to have fish, you know, with more healthy fats, all of these things. And really, you know, like I talked about with the exercise, also weights, these are all really important to introduce kind of perimenopausally, really. You know, it's never too early to kind of get these lifestyle things. I'm sure Robert would, you know, agree, you know, the earlier the better for everything.
Robert Byrne, if I could direct a question to yourself, post-operative, you know, patients who've maybe had a very serious event, you know, in terms of linking where those people might be, speaking to Robert Kelly's lifestyle approach, is there a particular approach that patients who fall into that profile should be taking, from your experience?
Yes, I think it's a very good question. All of the things that we've discussed here today are important in terms of preventing a first event, but they're also important in preventing a subsequent event in patients who have been unlucky enough to have symptomatic heart disease or to have a heart attack. We have a structured process called cardiac rehabilitation, which encompasses many of the domains that Robert would have mentioned earlier, but it's targeted specifically at patients who have suffered a heart event and enable them to get back to a good level of functioning. The same goes for patients who come to us with more chronic, stable symptoms. Our job as cardiologists is to prescribe the right treatment, to look at the long-term risks and try to moderate those risks. But more importantly, it's to enable them to do the things that they like doing and to make sure that we use stents, bypass surgery, medications to give them the quality of life that they want so they can enjoy the activities they like doing.
Do men or women have a different attitude to accepting what's happened to them and how they need to go forward?
It's hard to know. There are differences. I mean, you touched on it earlier on when you asked about the social differences. And, you know, one of the things that we worry about is that heart disease is underrepresented in women. And we know if we look at the causes of death in men and women, they're broadly similar. About a third die of cardiovascular disease, about a third die of cancer, and about a third die of other causes. But yet, if you go and look at the heart attack registries or the heart attack audits, you'll see that men are represented three times more commonly than women. So there's an obvious disconnect there. Part of it is to do with these slightly different symptoms that people present with. But we also think there's a different threshold for presentation in women, perhaps. You know, perhaps they're less likely to bring troubling symptoms to attention. They don't want to cause worry. Maybe their main, they have a caregiving function and they're conscious of other roles that they have, perhaps to their own neglect. We always think about the Mrs. Doyle syndrome. Oh, don't mind me. I'm just over here having a heart attack. Yeah. But that's perhaps, you know, an extreme example. But it's something that patients need to be aware of. And also doctors and healthcare providers need to, I think, adjust their antenna for heart disease in women.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. We're going to kind of draw proceedings to a close now. I suppose the important question is, where can people go to find good evidence-based information to maintain their health? Any of you who'd like to answer that question. Robert.
I think the most important thing is if you're not feeling right, particularly women, because we've said the symptoms can vary a little bit. If you're just not sure and there's something that's bothering you, well, then go and make an appointment with the GP and go and talk to the GP. Don't put it off, because that's the biggest mistake you'll ever make. Just don't do that. And that's not to say that you can't start off on a good footing and do all these measures that we spoke about. In fact, everybody should be doing that. I think if you want to source information, instead of hitting the internet and looking for heart attack and seeing what comes up, and or checking in with your ChatGPT and seeing if it can tell you, I think you're better off going to reliable sources. So I find that the Irish Heart Foundation is a good source of information locally. I think a lot of the very well-known international medical centres like the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic and even the European Society of Cardiology, they're very valid, reliable sources of information. But any of the women's magazines, I'm afraid, and all the other ones are not quite as accurate, perhaps, in terms of the information that their patients have been looking for.
Una, from your perspective?
Yeah, I would agree. The Irish Heart Foundation has a fantastic set of videos there, you know, which are really informed and evidence-based. And there's also a GP in Dublin, Dr Deirdre Lundy, and she has written a fantastic book on menopause, and there's quite a good chapter in there on cardiovascular health and menopause, and it's as good as for clinicians as, you know, people who are not doctors. It's very readable and it's an excellent source of information.
Robert, any last suggestion from yourself?
Yeah, no, I would echo what's been said already, but I would say heart disease is common. We know a lot of the risk factors, but even people who pay attention to all of these risk factors, they can still run into trouble because heart disease is common. And I think if you're worried, the thing to do is to go and talk to your GP. Perhaps you need to see a cardiologist. There are set risk tables that GPs, that cardiologists can access and say, listen, you know, what's your LDL cholesterol? What's your bad cholesterol? What's your average blood pressure? And they can factor these things in and give you an idea. Are you a low risk category? Are you intermediate risk? Or are you high risk category, and maybe in a proportion of those, even if you're feeling well but you fall in the higher risk category, then they'll do additional testing. So I think rather than going to Google and looking for this information and symptoms, talk to your GP or your cardiologist, and they can give you more concrete advice. And what I always say to people is, take ownership of it. I think know what your bad cholesterol level is, know what your blood pressure levels are, and don't be afraid to ask your doctor, where am I and am I meeting my targets? Because we have well-defined targets for what will minimize your risk over the longer term. These therapies to lower cholesterol or to control blood pressure, they won't make a difference to you today or tomorrow or next week or next month, but maybe 5 or 10 years or 15 years down the line, you'll be grateful that these measures were introduced. The earlier you start, often the better. It's like money in the bank over the longer term. But again, your GP or your cardiologist can advise when the appropriate time is to take action on these parameters.
You as clinicians, do you think you have enough support from our policymakers and politicians for the goals that you have?
So I think it's a struggle. I think cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in both men and women. And I think partially doctors who treat patients with cardiovascular disease, in some respects, were a victim of our own success, because there has been very substantial progress in reducing the risk of dying due to cardiovascular disease over the last 50 years. Incremental benefit in picking up heart attacks in a timely manner, in sending patients to coronary care units, emergency angiograms day or night, opening up blocked arteries. So we've made important strides, but still it remains cardiovascular disease in general the leading cause of death and disability in men and women. So I think ongoing funding for research in this area is paramount. And of course, there's competition and there's other areas of medicine which are competing for these supports. But I think in cardiovascular medicine, we need to be strong in standing up and advocating for our patients and making sure that there's adequate supports for research and prevention programs.
Have any of you any last messages for the audience watching or listening today that you'd like to share?
I just had one message, and that is, we've given you a lot of information in the presentation. I'd strongly encourage you to, after listening to it once, maybe go back and listen to it or watch it a couple of times and make a few notes and follow through on some of the actions that each of us have suggested so that you can start dealing with your health today instead of waiting till you reach the menopause or after the menopause.
Absolutely. And just that, genes do play a role in cardiovascular disease, but modifiable risks that we talked about play an even bigger role. And, we do have control over these and we can change our risks and lower our risks. So, it's never too late and you should get started today.
Robert?
Yeah, I think a lot of the discussion today has been about heart disease in women, heart disease, what differentiates them from heart disease in men. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that heart disease is common in both men and women. There are differences in terms of how it makes itself known, but actually there are also a lot of similarities, and look out for symptoms that are of concern, pressure in the chest, breathlessness on exertion, a discomfort in the jaw or the shoulders. These can all be signs of heart disease which should prompt you to seek attention and advice in a timely manner.
Given the prevalence. Many thanks to all of you. Really appreciate and for the interesting discussion. Thank you. That concludes our discussion today. I just want to say many thanks to our speakers, Professor Robert Byrne, Dr. Robert Kelly and Dr. Una O'Neill. Further details about upcoming episodes in the RCSI My Health series can be found on the RCSI website. You can also find the RCSI My Health series episodes across all major podcast platforms. RCSI is committed to improving human health, and we're really proud to be ranked first in the world for our impact on good health and well-being. Thanks again to our partners Fleming Medical. Fleming Medical is an Irish-owned family business with 35 years' experience working with pharmacy and healthcare professionals, and we're delighted to have their support for this year's series. From all of us here from RCSI University of Medicine and Health Sciences, thank you for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to RCSI My Health. We hope you found this episode useful and informative. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you can stay up to date on health-related topics directly from the experts. For more information on RCSI My Health series, please visit rcsi.com/myhealthlectures.